Yeah.
Hello.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming to this Prospect OUP debate. Our panelists this evening are so distinguished that it would take up too much time to list their distinctions, and in any case, when they start to explain themselves, you'll all see how brilliant and knowledgeable they are, and long introductions will merely get in the way of this discovery. So I will simply say, in alphabetical order along the platform, that Susan Greenfield is Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Oxford, Director of the Royal Institute of Great Britain, and the author, most recently, of The Human Brain. Sir Roger Penrose is the Rouse Ball Professor of Mathematics at Oxford, author of Shadows of the Mind and The Emperor's New Mind. Dan Robinson is a distinguished research professor at Georgetown University and editor of the Oxford Reader on the Mind, whose publication we have gathered here to celebrate. Aaron Sloman is the Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Cognitive Science at the University of Birmingham. He describes himself as a failed mathematician who calls himself a philosopher and enjoys building software tools for modeling minds. Galen Strawson is the tutor in philosophy and fellow of Jesus College and author, most recently, of Mental Reality. The evening's going to be divided into two halves. In the first, the panelists will speak for 7 minutes or so each. This will be followed by questions from the audience. In the second half of the evening, after a break, the format will be reversed. There'll be 45 minutes of questions from the audience. The panelists will then sum up. I should also say there's a bookstall out there where you can deepen your acquaintance with the thoughts on things. So, with no more fuss, our first speaker is Galen Strawson.
Visible. Great. So, well, there's nothing I can do about it. Oh, well, I will say it. So, I was told I have 6 minutes, so here goes. Is the brain a computer? It's not made of metal, silicon, and plastic, so it's not a computer in this sense. So, that's my number one. No, obviously no. And it's definitely not a computer if a computer is something whose workings don't involve consciousness. That's number two. Two no's. But now take the number 7, multiply it by itself, add 1, multiply by 2, take the square root, take away 1, take the square root again. What's the answer? Thank you. This shows that your brains, or at least some of them, are quite certainly computers. They compute things, and computers are things that compute things. And actually, that's rather a trivial example. Much more interesting is the unconscious computation that goes on when you run to catch a ball and so on. So far, we've got two no's and one yes. But should we take it to be true, as in two, that computers are, by definition, things that are not conscious? No. First, because our own brains are undoubtedly computers, as I've already said. Second, because we really have no good reason to think that artificially constructed, non-biological machines could never be conscious. And this takes me to the fourth main thing that people usually have in mind when they ask whether the brain's a computer. They're interested in the mind-body problem. They're wondering whether minds or brains are merely physical things, physical mechanisms of a certain sort. And that's what I want to say something about, finally. Well, I think the answer is yes. The mind or the mind-brain is a wholly physical thing. What's wrong is the word merely. There's nothing mere about it. The mind-body problem is almost always set up as the problem of how on earth consciousness can be something physical, given what we know about physical matter. But this is all wrong. We have no good reason to think we know anything about matter that gives us any reason to find any problem in the idea that consciousness is wholly physical. We think we pretty much know what matter is, but we don't. As Russell said, and I have this up here too, we're guilty unconsciously and in spite of explicit disavowals of a confusion in our imaginative picture of matter. Can we do anything about this? Can we do anything to make it seem less puzzling that consciousness is physical? I'm just going to tell a very simple story. So at first, perhaps, as a child, one takes it that matter is simply solid, non-particulate stuff. It's the ultimate Norwegian cheese. And then perhaps one learns that it's composed of distinct atoms, solid particles that cohere more or less closely together to make up objects, but that have empty space, loosely speaking, between them. And then perhaps one learns that the atoms are themselves made up of tiny separate particles and full of empty space themselves. Now, so far, this picture still has a place for minuscule, grainy bits of truly solid, ultimate stuff. But it's actually over 200 years since Joseph Priestley observed that there is no scientific warrant for this view, and it suffered many further blows in modern quantum theory. The truth is that physics thinks of matter as a thing of forces, energy, fields, and it can also seem rather natural to conceive of consciousness as a form or manifestation of energy, as a kind of force, and even perhaps as a kind of field. You may still think the two things are deeply heterogeneous, but you really have no good reason to believe this. We just don't know enough about the nature of matter. So when Colin McGinn, Susan Greenfield, and Tom Nagel expressed their bewilderment at how the brain can be the site of consciousness by speaking of soggy gray matter or brain gook, or of a sludgy mass, or of the squishy brain, they vividly express the imaginative confusion in our ordinary idea of matter. But we can avoid much of the confusion, because there's a clear sense in which the best description of matter, even in common sense terms, comes from physics. And what does physics find in the volume of space-time occupied by a brain? Not a sludgy mass, but an astonishingly insubstantial play of energy, an ethereally radiant form. It finds, in other words, a physical object, which, thus far examined, is like any other, for example, this lectern. But examined further, this particular physical object, the brain, turns out to have a vast further set of remarkable properties, all the sweeping sheets and fountains of bewilderingly complex electrochemical activity. All this being so, do we really have any good reason to think that consciousness is not an entirely physical thing? I think not. I'm inclined to put the point by saying that consciousness is a form of matter. And there's something very wrong with your notion of matter if you think I can't be right. That's it.
I think I'll use a new slide. Okay, I have lots of them, in fact. I'll choose a random subset. Anyway, all my slides can be obtained from there if you want them, if you can read that. And even if you can't, they can be obtained from there. Obviously, brains are not artifacts, which computers are. And obviously, they are not built like contemporary computers. So in that sense, brains are not computers. But that's trivial, and therefore...
Can you be heard?
Can I be heard when I step back? Could the people at the back hear me when I was out there? Could anybody who couldn't hear me wave a hand? Right, okay, I'll keep coming forward, but then I'll have to... That uses up 30 seconds. Right, thanks for stopping me. Okay. Obviously, in some trivial sense, brains are not computers, and I don't think any of us here are interested in trivial questions. We want to understand what we are. So I think the question we're asking about is what kind of machine can have mental states, and when we get on to that, will that rule out computers? Now, it's a long and complicated story. Here's a summary of it, which you can get if you're a spiritualist by talking to Gilbert Ryle and ask him what sort of ghost in the machine can think. And I think if you go and read his stuff, he'll tell you the answer. Every intelligent ghost must contain a machine. What sort of machine? An information processing machine. Now, what's an information processor? I think we're only just beginning to understand all that. But to follow on from what Galen was saying, there are at least three different kinds of machines that we've begun to understand in the last couple of thousand years. Energy manipulators, things like candles and bombs, matter manipulators, diggers and factory automation systems, and information manipulators. And we only recently begun to understand machines which manipulate information. And one of the things that's clear about brains is that they manipulate information. It's also clear that computers manipulate information. So what we have to try to understand is what, if anything, they have in common. If you want me to come back later, I could give you a two-hour lecture on what an information processor is. There are some low-level requirements for an information processor, whether it's a brain or a computer. To do its job, to do the kinds of things Galen was talking about and Susan and other people were talking about, you need to have rich variability of state. And one way of achieving that is to have many independently switchable components. Brains and computers both have that. If you've got n components, they're 2 to the n states, which can be an astronomical number, even if n is just several million. High connectivity. Well, in brains, you have high connectivity through lots of neurons going all over the place. In computers, you get that by having the random addressing mechanism. If you don't know what that is, ask me later, or ask the person sitting next to you. You need to have causal connections between states. If one thing happens, that should be able to cause another thing to happen. In brains, that can be done by chemical and electrical processes. In computers, that can be done by all kinds of things, including condition action rules of sorts that you learn about if you learn to program. And there are lots more. But that gives you a sort of feel for the kinds of ways in which we can avoid the trivial, shallow differences and go into the deeper underlying similarities by asking, what are the physical requirements? But if you go up a level of abstraction and ask, what sort of things do they do? You might, for instance, want to ask, what is consciousness? Well, some people assume consciousness is one thing, and then you can ask questions like, which animals have it? How did it evolve? What's its function? Which machines have it? And so on. I think that's a deep mistake. Consciousness is a cluster concept. What we call consciousness covers a large, ill-defined collection of capabilities. If you gave me time, I'd tell you some of them. But I'll tell you a small subset. So we have to talk about them, not it. And different animals will have different groups of them. And young newborn babies will have a subset that you don't have. It'll be a different subset. When you have Alzheimer's, you'll have yet another subset. And you may still be conscious in some sense. Well, what sorts of subsets? Well, we can have reactive capabilities. And I think you can see from this picture, a reactive system just has information coming in through sensors, various things happen inside, outputs go through motors, and that changes the environment. You have all kinds of feedback loops. You can have a system which, in addition to being reactive, may also be able to contemplate possible futures. So here we have a hybrid system. Perceptual mechanisms have to be more complicated. Hybrid system which can reason about what would happen if, which is what you need in order to deliberate, what would happen if somebody turned all the lights off, and then what would be the options available. That involves the ability to do things other than just react, to contemplate possible futures. Some animals can do that. I don't know how many. All animals have the first bit. So I assume the first bit, the reactive bit, evolved very early on, and at the bottom level, all computers do that too. But that's not enough. There are things that human beings can do which go beyond that. For instance, we can have, and I think some other animals can have, a third layer, which one of my students once called a meta-management layer, which can observe things happening in the others. Now, don't worry about the details. The important thing is these three levels can all function simultaneously, interacting with one another, doing different things using partly different and partly similar mechanisms. And I think this reflective layer probably evolved very much later and is shared with very few animals, and it's a particular kind of information processing. When robots have that, and they can start inspecting the internal states of some of their visual and other sensory mechanisms, they will invent qualia, at least the robots with a philosophical inclination. And they will start talking about consciousness and worrying about whether human beings are zombies because they're not made of the same kind of stuff as robots. Anyway, so we need to understand what kinds of information processing can account for the sorts of things we all know about ourselves and the sorts of things we don't know because people like Susan and others haven't told us yet. And you'll find out lots of them later. And of course, people who study animals will tell you things that animals can do that we can't, like birds migrating, maybe using magnetic sensors, which we don't have. And all sorts of amazing things, like crows that learn to use tools. Did you know they could do that? You should watch David Attenborough. So let me say, we are at the very early stages of understanding what computers are. We can build simple ones. We're beginning to start putting them together. We don't really know what kinds of things we can make by putting them together. Not just putting them together, different kinds of programming languages are being developed. They're extending all the time. There are already thousands of them. There'll be probably a few more thousand in the next 10 years, or at least in the next 20 years. We know something about the very simplest computers, Turing machines. Mathematicians and physicists and Roger like to talk about those. I do also in my mathematical moments. But we should get away from that and talk about large collections of information processing mechanisms working together to do all the kinds of things that I was talking about. Then we may be able to understand where this consciousness that we are all interested in can fit in, and also how brains work, because they're at a certain level of abstraction, we may find a lot in common, including, for instance, although I haven't got time to demonstrate that, the functions of chemical mechanisms. That was one of the slides I didn't show you. Anyway, so my conclusion is we don't yet know what computers really are. We're beginning to find out, and I think it's fairly clear that the brain is a computer, but we don't know what sort yet.
Well, I don't have any slides for you to be unable to see. And I don't have much by way of notes either. Is the brain a computer? I just got off a plane from the States yesterday, and I think I can speak for President Clinton in this regard. It all depends on what you mean by is. So the question, it seems to me, is whether a computer is an apt model of the brain, whether a computer in principle functions in such a way as to render it indistinguishable in its major performance from the sorts of things that brains do. And this, of course, sets to one side the question of whether what brains do fully captures what minds do. I might say something about that if I lapse into reveries during the second half of this. Is the computer a good model of the brain? And this, of course, raises the question of what makes a model a good model. Norbert Wiener, some of you will recall, the founder of cybernetics, was fond of saying that the best model of a cat is a cat, preferably the same cat. So there are models and models. Anything, for example, whose output characteristics for a given input satisfy the radar equation stands as a model of radar. And indeed, you could put together an indefinitely large number of devices such that if you put certain inputs into it, the output input-output relationship would satisfy the radar equation, and none of this would establish that the device in question had any point, really. That is, outside our own understanding of what radars are for, the mere presentation of the radar equation would tell you nothing about radars, just that it satisfied certain input-output constraints. And thus, the computational aspects of brain function in and of themselves might be quite literally pointless, do you see? The point of brain function is something inextricably bound up with a certain form of life, and therefore the achievement of the device might just leave that entire issue unaddressed. I'm not going to say anything about Johnny Searle's Chinese Room. There might be fluent Chinese ideogram readers in the group for whom that room wouldn't apply in any case. I'm certainly not going to say anything about Gödel's incompleteness theorem in present company, let alone Gottstein's, except to say that scanning the Gottstein theorem, we agreed no font can be made small enough actually to print up the results of that. There are technical limitations on this. What these offer, Gödel's theorem and the like, are formal arguments against the possibility of a computational device achieving what mental life achieves, what brain function allegedly achieves. On the question of models, it does seem to me that an adequate model of brain function simply will not match up with the sorts of things computers do, and in my own view, the sorts of things that computers imaginably might do. I don't want to be strident on this. With respect to ultimate questions regarding the universe, I only work here, do you see? So if it sounds strident, it's strident for the purposes of getting the debate going. What is it about mental life that seems to match up so poorly with anything that a computational device might do? The mental centrally is cultural. A la Wittgenstein, meaning as a set of conventions authorized by a given community, meaning as determined in actual practice by entities sharing a given form of life, just is something I can't see getting into the machine except by way of our putting it there. Mental life is inevitably selective. We are information processors, but we are bathed in potential information. We choose what to look at. The cocktail party effect is an interesting, if trite, example of that, do you see? It's not just information processing. It's picking out what to process and picking it out on the basis of its salience. And its salience is highly individuated. I might listen for the name Dan, and you might not, do you see? And this is not just the result of learning. It's tied in with all sorts of things that are not brain, but visceral and emotional, and again, cultural and often episodic. The mental is utterly individuated. The sense in which Jack and Jane and Jim and Bill are, quote, the same mentally is a trivial sense. And of course, what individuates them as persons is what gets us interested in each other in the first instance. I don't think that I'd be particularly interested in copies of Deep Blue, even if every one of them beat Kasparov. They'd all be doing the same thing. And the question wouldn't be whether it's a good performance. It would be that it's a performance, do you see? There's something utterly inauthentic about it. The mental is ineliminably value-based. After all, when we go through these calculations, even the one that Galen treated us to, it usually is with some purpose in mind, and that purpose fits in with the larger projection of our own lives. And it seems to me that coming up with a toy or a device that does some part of that, but doesn't actually bear upon the central point of life, is a sort of joke we play on ourselves. Then there's the sense of complexity in the formal mathematical sense of complexity. We equate the complexity of a system with the shortest apt description that can be given of it. But then try to imagine the complexity of the civic, moral, and political dimensions of life. There is no shortest sentence to capture this. So there's a kind of modal mismatch, ontological mismatch between the manner in which we would specify the complexity of any imaginable computer and the complexity of the sort of life we live. And then finally, there's Bill James's. William James was the quintessential American philosopher, you know. He had a Turkish contempt for metaphysical complexities. And the Jamesian pragmatistic test, do you see, if you've got this Cheltenham and Gloucester mortgage payment that's meeting you tomorrow, and the question arises, might you be settling all this computationally? You just look back and say, well, come on now, get off it. The rider of the Clapham omnibus goes around with daily concerns that just don't become illuminated or resolved on the showing that what he's doing is computational. For that person, whether or not the mind or the brain is a computer is really irrelevant to the day-to-day affairs of life. It's an interesting conceptual question, but ultimately these conceptual questions either remain merely conceptual questions or they actually transform our sense of ourselves. And I don't believe that either way we answered this question would radically transform our sense of ourselves.
I hope I can get that all on here.
It's upside down. It's all right.
Yes. We could try it that way. I'll have to move it at some point. Well, I want to address this question of whether mentality is computational or not. And to me, the term computational, if that helps, to me, the term computational actually does have a clear meaning. And computers, as we understand them today, basically do computation. And a computation, if you want to know something, whether something's a computation or not, you just ask whether a computer can do it. It's not quite the same thing in the sense that mathematical notion of computation requires that you have an infinite storage or potentially infinite storage and so on. But these issues are not usually the ones that are important. So I don't think the question of what a computer, what's computational or not, is really a contentious issue. At least to me it's not. I mean, well, it might have discussions afterwards. But the question one might raise here is mentality. I can crudely divide into conscious and unconscious. Many of the actions that we perform all the time, when we walk down the street, for example, are performed entirely unconsciously. And I have nothing against these unconscious aspects of mentality being entirely computational. Perhaps you could simulate that according to neural network systems. However, when we talk about conscious activity, I have a different answer for that. We can again divide conscious mentality into two classes, broadly, say active, that's to do with free will, passive to do with what philosophers call qualia, basically things like pain or the perception of the color red or so on. But I actually want to concentrate on something which is rather between these two, and I think the word understanding is a useful word to use here. And I'm only going to be talking about a rather specific kind of understanding, namely that which is involved in mathematical thinking. And here's where Gödel's theorem, I would claim, clearly shows that there is something outside computation involved in our mathematical understanding. I'm going to have arguments about this, and many people do, but certainly my position, which I claim one can actually demonstrate, is that mathematical understanding, at least some aspects of mathematical understanding, are outside computation. That means there's something in our conscious activity which is outside computation. Of course, you might draw the line any place here. It might be between the Gödel theorem understanding and any other form of mathematics, if you like. Just seems to me that's unreasonable. It's also unreasonable, it seems to me, to draw the line between mathematical understanding and other forms of understanding. I would regard it as unreasonable to draw the line between understanding and other forms of consciousness, because consciousness does at least seem to me, despite the many variants of it, something quite different from unconscious things. So I think there is something profoundly different here from here, and if there is to be a line drawn, it seems to me that the line is drawn here between the conscious and unconscious. Well, there may be unconscious things which are outside computation too, I don't know about that, but at least I would argue that consciousness, conscious mentality, is something which you cannot even simulate on a computer adequately. Now, I've raised a question here. Is conscious understanding something that can be simulated? I just put four different points of view here by computation. I'm saying, according to me, no, so I put a line through it. Of course, these things are contentious. I'm not saying that everybody would agree with me here, but it seems to me that at least I would regard it as a no here. Known science. Now, here's an interesting issue. Can we at least understand what consciousness is in principle in terms of the science we know today? And my argument is that we cannot, that they have to be something outside science that we know today, not outside science altogether, but outside the science that we know now. So I would claim that it's some unknown science. And here's the other alternative. You might think that it's something beyond science in some sense. But I think the question of what science is a rather fluid one. And certainly, as Galen was pointing out earlier, and I agree with him, what we mean by matter, what the word materialist actually means, is something rather obscure in terms of modern physics. Because what is matter, what is a material entity, is not so clear at all. I don't want to go into that now, but that certainly, what you mean by materialist is to me very unclear. But anyway, if it's an outside known science, and my reason for thinking it's outside known science is basically, if you look at what known science is, and that has sort of two aspects to it, classical physics, such large-scale objects like this pointer and cricket ball and so on and so forth, or what governs the behavior of small-scale things, particles, atoms, molecules, and so on. I put these in quotes because there are some questions about what you're talking about is large or small. But there are these two realms of physical understanding, and the basic thing that we don't know, I would argue, is the link between the two. How is it that somehow these two completely different pictures of the world can come together coherently? And our present-day theory, in my view, and in the view of a lot of people, is simply not coherent in that respect. We don't understand how they come together. In fact, I think one can argue that there is something profoundly missing from our physical understanding. So there is something missing here, and it's, of course, you might argue whether that missing science is the relevant science here. Of course, it might. We have to look further. But I think there's a lot of plausibility that it's in this missing link between the small scale and the large scale physics. In fact, there are some experiments I haven't time to describe here which could actually test whether the kind of proposal that I'm putting forward actually holds or not. And I hope people will do these experiments. I'm waiting to see whether they're going to be funded or not. Well, I don't know yet. But then the question arises, are this physical missing physics here, which I think one can argue is definitely missing, is it of relevance to brain action? And here I think a lot of people would find it very hard to see how you could be bringing something in which is at the sort of borderline between classical and quantum physics, could have profound relevance to the way the brain operates. Now I think it's very likely that this is the case. In fact, my argument has to drive me almost to the conclusion that it must be the case. But then you have to look and see, is there anything in the brain that could be relevant to this kind of classical quantum borderline? And it seems to me that one can't expect to find this in ordinary actions of neuron firing. It's got to be something deeper, maybe what controls the strengths of synapses and so on. And I am rather drawn to the idea that it's something to do with the structures which are deeper in cells, the cytoskeleton, and in particular these tubes known as microtubules, which to me are the most likely place to support the kind of large-scale quantum coherence. So you have something which is genuinely in the borderline here, something like, there are things called superconductors and superfluids, which are large-scale quantum things, and usually they're thought to exist only at very low temperatures, absolute zero practically, there are now known to be things called high-temperature superconductors. They're not body temperature, but they're something like halfway there. So it seems to me not implausible that something like this could be of profound relevance in the action of the brain, and then you could expect to see something of this borderline between these two areas of physics playing a relevant role, and this would be where the action that is outside computation would come in. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening. As a neuroscientist, you might have thought I'd have lots of pictures of brains and so on, but I don't even have overheads, I'm afraid. I think, like the other panelists, I'd just like to, first of all, dispense with what I regard as the trivial issues. The first is that responses aren't key. All of you are sitting here, more or less, not moving, but you'd avow, I'm sure, that you are conscious. I hope you would. On the other hand, we all know of machines and computers that emit responses and buses that say that they're reversing, and no one claims that they are conscious. So that's an issue that I don't think we really need detain us. The other issue is, of course, the ad absurdum argument, which is when you're pushed into a corner, people say, well, if I built a computer, but a computer that was just like the brain, in its three-dimensional physico-chemical complexity, down to every last dendrite, that's a dangly thing on a brain cell, every last process, 100 billion brain cells, 10 times more glial cells, 100,000 connections to each. If I did all that, that would be conscious. Now, of course it would, because it's a tautology to say if you built something down to every last atom, that was just like the brain. Of course it would be just like the brain in every regard, and I regard that as a non-issue. What is more interesting is the baby bathwater issue of what is there special about brains, and does a computer, could a computer share that specialness? The final trivial issue is, can a brain be like a computer? And both Roger and Galen have touched on this. And of course, in some respects, it can be. As they've said, one can drive in a subconscious way. One can have automated processes. For example, the cauliflower structure at the back of your head. The cerebellum has been dubbed the autopilot of the brain. And people can successfully model that on a computer, the sensory inputs and the motor outputs. So again, I think the issue is not so much, can a brain be like a computer, but can a computer be like a brain? And here I think, for me, the critical issue is that, as far as I understand it, people that tackle this question put a huge premium on learning and memory. Forget about the issue of the responses, which of course one always has to look at just the responses, but it's the learning and memory skills, and that's where I have problems. Take a one-day-old baby that is not known for its learning and memory skills, and in any event, all these computers can outstrip us in learning and memory skills. So it strikes me as a rather strange thing to chase and to get ever more complex machines that are ever better at learning and memory skills and expect deus ex machina, suddenly, plonk, we're going to have emotion as a result, or feelings, or consciousness. As Stuart Sutherland once says, he'd believe a computer to be conscious when it runs off with his wife. to suddenly expect that to happen as a result of being ever better at playing chess, for example. Myself, I have problems with that kind of logic. So what other factor is there? What is it that we should be chasing? Well, to my mind, let's go back to our baby again, or indeed to the cuckolded husband or tearaway wife. It's feelings. Emotions, surely, are the building blocks of consciousness. And let me present the following syllogism. Emotions are modified by drugs. Anyone on Prozac or who's taken ecstasy or LSD or morphine, I'm sure will testify to that. Drugs work by modifying chemicals in the brain, different types of chemicals in different ways. Ergo, this is a kind of haiku. Drugs, therefore, if they modify chemicals in the brain, emotions must have a chemical basis. Ergo, consciousness must somehow have some kind of chemical basis. Now, I don't subscribe to some airy-fairy mental Planet Zog thing being transmitted in or some kind of non-physical stance. But at the same time, rather like with Roger, I don't see that by adopting the idea that things are not computational, one has to be pushed into the corner of saying that things aren't physical. I think the brain is very much physical. But I think its specialness resides not only in its 100 billion 100 billion neurons, its 100,000 connections between each, but in its use of chemicals in a three-dimensional matrix that is very hard to tease out the baby from the bathwater. So, for my mind, until we have computers or we address the issue of computers being happy or feeling pain, irrespective of the responses, then I, for one, am not convinced that computers are like brains. Now, what of the future, I would not be arrogant enough to say, in the future, this will never happen. I could say 2 and 2 will never be 5. I might even say pigs will never fly, because that obeys certain physical laws. Those that same kind of laws do not apply to saying, oh, computers will never be conscious. But I cannot see, with my knowledge of the brain as it is, for what it is, my knowledge of how computationalists are proceeding, for what that is, I can't see how they're going along the path. And I can't see how it will help anyway, because if you knew a computer was conscious, then you'd be in the same state as when confronted with biological brain. If you didn't know what the special factor was, and of course it could feel pain and so on, you'd be as ethically constrained as you are with biological brains. And if you did know what it was, if you did know the baby, so you could throw out the bathwater, then why bother in the first place if you know it already? So my own view is that we're being asked by the computationally minded to adopt an article of faith, and it's, for my part, one that I'm not prepared to adopt at this stage. Thank you.
Right, well, we now move into the questions before the break. I'm sure there must be some. You said a microphone.
It's just a quick question. Do you consider that there could be a fusion between the conjectural sciences and the positivistic sciences? You seem to be divided, but the fusion, could somebody say something about the fusion of the two? Maybe that is the way forward, not the division between
it
the...
It would be easier if you could explain what you mean by the conjectural and what...
The conjectural sciences are the sciences with regard to language, linguistics. Somebody mentioned Wittgenstein, but I'm thinking beyond Wittgenstein. I think Lacan actually looks at the positivistic sciences and the conjectural sciences fusing together.
Well,
a quick answer is that artificial intelligence is doing exactly that. Lots of conjecture, using the best available technology, which is as positivistic as you want, to try to explore all kinds of ideas.
Thank you. Yeah, I just add that there's a lot of interaction between them as it is. I don't know what fusion would amount to. You know, they're talking to each other a lot. Philosophers are interested in what's happening in science. And actually, it's happening the other way around as well.
This is more for the physicists. Does it exist at the present time any way of producing computation by using fields, physical fields, like a magnetic field or electric field?
I think the question, shall I answer that? Has to do with... discrete or continuous, can I take your question that way? Because, of course, electric and magnetic fields are very much involved in ordinary computers.
So and in the brain also.
Yeah, I mean, this is all very much an integral part of the way the physical world operates at the level that we understand it. But I think, as I take your question, it may be to do with whether we can talk about continuous or discrete system. I mean, a computer is deliberately a discrete system. It's digital, if you like. Whereas you could have other systems where you have continuous parameters, like a field strength or something like that. And the question I think you're asking is whether you get something different when you talk about field strengths. I mean, an analog device is, after all, something of that nature. I mean, our present understanding, which is not complete, I would say not complete on this issue, is that anything which involves continuous parameters deliberately could be simulated to an accuracy that you require by digital means, usually more effectively. So as our understanding is at the moment, I don't think importing continuous parameters gives you something new. But there are mathematical issues which I think are somewhat unresolved here. In fact, even what you mean by computation when you have continuous parameters involved is not a settled issue, whereas with discrete systems, there is one notion of computability which everybody agrees about. And I'm talking about the ideal notion, so I don't know, Aaron might have different views about. There's one mathematical notion, whereas with continuous systems, it's not clear. But I think it's, my own view is that simply that doesn't give you really anything new.
But is it, can one computate using continuous or discontinuous?
Well, you can, sure. I mean, you can. Lots of people throughout, Maxwell devised machines which had rolling balls and things. You can have machines which involve continuous parameters. But the trouble is that there's the accuracy. I mean, how accurate? You can only measure it to a certain degree of accuracy. And so, in a sense, you can approximate that by some digital system. So it's not clear that you get something new that way. But you can certainly incorporate fields. Yeah. I don't think it gives you anything new at that level. I'm still classical.
Right. Sorry, Galen, you wanted.
This is not the physicist's notion of field. It's more metaphorical and chemical. But I think I believe that at Sussex, at the university at the moment, they're modeling something like the diffusion of chemicals in the brain to have, and they're using nitric oxide. It's only modeled on a computer. But in that sense of a chemical field, it seems that it doesn't just have to be little synapses connecting up with each other. And that may be, that's also partly a response to what Susan's been saying, that it does look as if they're going to be able to start modeling something like the chemical action in the brain in computers in the future.
I don't think I did say that.
No, sorry. No.
As I said, I've yet to be convinced that people are even looking at that, but it's not a simple thing of one chemical diffusing. It's the interaction of a chemical with its targets, and that is so multivarious, depending on both quantitative and qualitative factors, that you would have to pretty much build the whole extracellular matrix, the whole brain, in order to simulate the action before you could be sure, dead sure, that you hadn't thrown the baby out with the bathwater.
Yes, gentlemen, up there. Yeah. Oh, right. Unless one is a dualist, one presumably believes that whatever happens in conscious experience is in a one-to-one correspondence with brain events. I don't know whether all the speakers would agree with that. But in that case, presumably, any actual computation, the mechanics of it, occur in the physical brain, and the consciousness is an epiphenomenal byproduct. I would like to ask, in particular, Professor Greenfield, whether she believes that anything that the brain does is done by the physical brain, and there can't be any special thing such as mathematical proof or some other special creative ability which is actually not accomplished by the physical brain but done by consciousness itself, as Professor Penrose seems to imply.
My own view is that consciousness is by, for, and of the brain, and therefore we know that you can manipulate physical things and manipulate consciousness. So I agree with you. I'd say that there was perhaps some final configuration, some final net state that correlated with certain types of consciousness. I think another important issue to realize if we're talking about the physical brain is that you must always remember the physical brain is in a physical body. It's very much influenced by hormones, by feedback from your vital organs, and similarly sends out signals to your body. This is another problem, incidentally, that the computationalists haven't really addressed. So my own view is, yes, I think it is entirely physical. That does not mean to say that I believe in the computational stance.
Since my name has been brought in here, maybe I should just respond. I certainly don't believe that there is some mystical thing which comes in when you prove something and it comes from something non-physical. That's not my view at all. My view is that the physical brain, yes, I mean, that's what we're looking at, that's what we're talking about, and consciousness is a feature of what happens with the physical brain. The question is what that really means, because we don't really know what physical means yet. And physical, to me, means something distinctly, particularly when we're talking about consciousness, something outside the framework of physics that we have now. It's just that we're at a too early stage in our understanding of the physical world. But I think, as I was trying to say, I can even point to the area where I believe we have to extend our physics. It's not saying that we have to look outside physics to something mystical or something like that. I'm certainly not saying that.
If it's necessary just to keep the ball in play for someone to be a dualist tonight, I'll be happy to be a dualist. After all, I'm flying home on Sunday. Most of the allegedly telling arguments against dualism, most of them based on a total misunderstanding, for example, of what Descartes' argument was, most of the arguments simply presuppose the validity of a monistic materialism, and then point out, given the truth of that, dualism must be false. A very learned scientist by the name of Aristotle was fond of making the distinction between the kinds of explanation that we get from one he referred to as the physikos, the natural scientist, and one he referred to as the electikos, who would be the disputant, philosophically oriented person. If you ask for a good explanation of Smith's anger, the physikos tells you that that anger is just variations in the temperature of certain fluids in the system. It's a good physiological account of the necessary preconditions for a state of anger. If you ask a moral philosopher or a psychologist to explain the anger, the answer is likely to be in terms of thinking of oneself as having been wrongly slighted. Now, I think this Pax Philosophica, or unity of science's aim, in which all these different notions collapse into one, will be at a very, very great cost. We would no longer be able to speak intelligently about our feelings, about being slighted, about what it is that makes us angry, let alone about what would be a just verdict in adjudication, if we started talking about changes in the temperature of fluids in our system, or any other even exotic précis about the anatomy and functional organization of the brain. This is why, with all due respect, I do think we tend to play tricks on ourselves when we try to take something quite well understood at a common sense day-to-day level and put it into terms that are and are likely to remain entirely arcane in all contexts except the context that has the committed assembling, the annual neural science meetings and so forth. One final point. When the Churchlands argue that we're not going to be talking about color when we grow up, we're going to be talking about the relevant cortical triune system, one wonders how you're ever going to attach that relevant cortical triune system to anything except on the assumption of the perception of color. Do you see, if you don't take the folk psychology for granted, you'll have nothing to tie these processes to, and instead of there being a mind-brain problem, there might be a mind-spleen problem or a spleen-kidney problem, do you see? So we don't have to leave here doubtful of our own psychological reality until some brain scientist confirms it for us. Now, that's a kind of closet dualism. Last point. The reason I'm not a dualist is I don't know what the ultimate constituents of reality are. There may be 64 different kinds, do you see? So two would really be on the cheap.
That leads quite nicely into what I wanted to say about this topic, because I think we ask these questions. Is it one kind of stuff? Is it two kind of stuff? And these are old questions. We should replace them. What kinds of stuff are there? And the answer is very many, and probably infinitely many different kinds, because reality is built in layers. Poverty is a different kind of stuff from thoughts. Thoughts are a different kind of stuff from brain processes. They're all different. What we need to do is understand the relationship between them. Now, if we don't know enough about how these things work, we may postulate simple-minded relationships like the one we were offered there, that if something happens at a higher level, which is implemented in a lower level, then there must be a one-to-one correspondence. If you study some computer science and software engineering, you'll discover that's not the case. You can have, for example, in a computer, an array, which is a structure with large numbers of components, which is bigger than could fit into the universe, if you try to find physical components to correspond to each of the elements. It's called a sparse array, for those of you who know what I'm talking about. And you can have processes going on in that thing, and the processes need not have any simple one-to-one correspondence with the underlying physical mechanisms. In fact, in general, one of the things that characterizes the development of computing is breaking the close connection between the processes going on at higher levels and the underlying physical processes. That's where the flexibility of computers comes from. That's how you can have word processes which manipulate paragraphs and chapters and fonts, which are nothing like the physical objects in the computer on which they're based. There aren't any simple correspondences. If you want to understand what that is, learn how to build a simple computer. Then you can start asking about more complicated things like minds and brains, or poverty and psychology and things of that sort.
Yeah, I just want to disagree on one point there, which is I don't think it's true to say that thoughts are different from brain processes. I think that's unfair to brain processes. It's the thing is we don't know enough about the nature of the matter of which they're made up, and I think that thoughts are perhaps a form of matter. That's all.
Galen has a special notion of identity, and when he uses that notion of identity, I agree with him. But there's another notion of identity in which poverty just isn't made of all the bits of chemicals.
Two descriptions, but one thing.
We have one more question before the break. Yes, lady down there. Oh, sorry. Oh, I see. Sorry. Okay, sorry.
Yes, can I say two things? The first thing is directed at Aaron. My own feeling is that there aren't different layers of reality. There's just one reality and different layers of description, but perhaps that's something we could take up later if you don't think it's simply a pedantic point. More substantive point, really, in response to what Susan was talking about. I very much like this idea of centering the problem in feelings rather than thinking or intelligence. I mean, I think you can be incredibly stupid and yet nevertheless be vividly conscious, just as vividly conscious as anything in this room. So I think that's a very useful corrective to the sort of artificial intelligence approach. Having said that, however, I was a little bit puzzled by what she said, or at least I wasn't sure what exactly she was claiming. I mean, no doubt one could establish correlations between feelings and the distribution of all kinds of chemicals in the brain. But having established such a correlation, there would still be two possibilities. One would be that my subjective life, my conscious life, is directly dependent upon the chemicals, and the other possibility is no. What it's directly dependent on is the nerve action, and it's simply the chemicals that trigger the nerves. And I just wondered whether there was any way of getting a scientific or experimental handle on those two possibilities.
Yes. I think the first distinction I want to make is between my arguments against brains being like computers, where I think we agree, and the second is the grand Greenfield theory of consciousness, which I wasn't inflicting on anyone this evening. My own view, without doing the latter, is simply to do the disclaimers. I think people make mistakes when they talk about the gene for this or that, the brain region for this or that, or indeed the chemical for this or that. You cannot reduce a complex net state to any of its constituent parts, be it genes, chemicals, brain regions, or tiny little circuits. I think the way to proceed is to look for how, if we're talking about higher order organization, genes and chemicals and circuits and electrical impulses all so configure and conspire within the brain from one second or one moment to the next to correlate with types of consciousness. That, I think, is in the grasp of science in the future. If we have more time, I could explore how I think that could be done. I think that's within the grasp of science in the future, but I think we should be cautious not to fall into the great love affair with imaging, for example, brain imaging, where one thinks that just because you have a correlation, you have a causality. I think it's another intellectual challenge entirely to say how a brain configuration, whatever that may be, actually correlates with falling in love or having a headache. I think that's a completely different type of intellectual challenge, and one I'm less optimistic about compared to the correlations, which I'm very optimistic about.
Can I come back on the question of emotions? Because you may be surprised to know that although I'm in a computer science department and I use artificial intelligence as a way of doing philosophy, I have for the last 20 or so years been thinking hard about emotions, motivation, feeling, moods, attitudes, and a lot of things besides learning and perception and problem solving. Because I think that, like Susan, I believe those are crucial to understanding what we are. That's my ultimate goal. And I didn't give you my slides on that, but I'll summarize one of the main conclusions, that there are different kinds of emotions. And there's one whole class of emotions connected with what I call the reactive layer in our architecture, which is very old. We share with a lot of other animals. Things like being startled by a noise, disgusted by a smell, and various other kinds of things. There's another whole class of emotions which have to do with having that deliberative capability that I mentioned in the second layer, which involves the ability to contemplate possible futures, being apprehensive, being relieved that something that might have happened doesn't happen. There's a whole variety of kinds of things that depend on that, which we have, and I expect a smaller subset of other animals have, and it evolved much later. And then there's a third class, which I call tertiary emotions. Other people have talked about primary and secondary emotions, Damasio, for instance. Tertiary emotions depend on that third layer, which can monitor, evaluate, and to some extent, but only partially, control what's happening within the system. And when we have emotions like guilt, humiliation, shame, which involve our partially losing our ability to control what we're thinking about, you think you want to get on with the job, but your mind is pulled back to that humiliating experience you had yesterday or whatever, you can't lose control unless you had control. What sort of control? Control that I think may have something to do with stuff in the frontal lobe that Damasio and other people have talked about. Susan probably knows a lot more about than I do. But my point is, there are different classes of emotions. They involve different kinds of information-based control processes, and we really can begin to understand them by analyzing them in great detail and trying to see how to replicate, maybe only in a crude way, at least some aspects of them, And of course, we may well find that some of the processes that chemicals are involved in, which include modulation of those things, may have to be replicated at a software level if you want to get them into computers.
Could I make one comment, or do you? Yes. I didn't, of course, say anything about emotion in my own talk, but the main reason is that when one talks about mathematical understanding, then I can say something about it. Whereas I certainly agree that discussing emotions is quite crucial, and that some, I would argue that something that has emotions has to involve this aspect of physics that we don't understand yet. I think it's even, I would even go more primitively than perhaps the emotions that Aaron referred to are a little bit up higher than I would like to refer. What about pain? I mean, pain seems to me something, I mean, it's distinctly different, the feeling of pain from the instinctive reaction that one has on touching hot stove and removing one's hand. And you could certainly imagine a computational device which did the removing of its arm. But does it actually feel pain? And we know it's something different. But how do you, from the point of view of AI, make this distinction?
How long do you want to wait for an answer?
can I just very, very briefly just gild the question further? Not only do I agree wholeheartedly with Roger that you must dissociate a pain response, a reflex, if you like, from the sensation of pain, but pain is a really interesting issue and a great challenge to someone who's trying to model this, because it can vary from the morning to the afternoon, for example. There's a nice sadistic experiment where students had shocks through their teeth, and they had to say when it was most painful, and the threshold, the so-called pain threshold, varied from day to day. We know that if you anticipate pain, then it's worse. We know that people without a limb can feel phantom limb pain. We know that morphine makes you, perhaps the pain not go away, but simply you feel the pain, but it doesn't matter. Pain is enormously exciting and intriguing and complex phenomena, and it's at the very least subjective, and at the very most a great challenge.
I absolutely agree with Susan that responses are irrelevant. That's why computations are important. They're what go on inside.
Sorry, Dan had one thing.
Yes, just one. This, I think, illustrates the point very well. When one gets to the level of emotion, we almost inevitably talk about things like pain, fear, these sort of episodic things that can be induced in an infrahuman or human animal very quickly. Think of this. Think of this aspect of one's affective life. Jealousy and envy. And I want you to consider the psychological and cultural and moral resources that go into those two states. Aristotle makes a very important distinction between jealousy and envy. When Smith is jealous of Jones, Smith finds something good in Jones that Smith is lacking and wishes that he had. When Smith is envious of Jones, he finds something he wishes Jones didn't have. The great, great vice, do you see, the great vice of envy is that it is the one flaw in character that would, if it could, reduce the total goodness in the world. Now, if you ask yourselves what it takes to be in a state of envy or a state of jealousy, and then get back to the question of some sort of computational model of this kind of thing, I think you do begin to sense the potential hopelessness of this agenda.
On which inspiring note, we'll take a break.
15 minutes. We'll resume in, well, since we're slightly overrunning, we'll resume in 10 minutes, okay?
Thank you. Hello. We have a start now. Okay. For the benefit, really, of the people who are in the audiovisual room and thus may have missed a certain, I'm going to reintroduce our panelists briefly and in the opposite order again. We have over here Galen Strawson, who is the tutor in philosophy and fellow of Jesus College. We have Aaron Sloman, who's a professor of artificial intelligence and cognitive science at the University of Birmingham. Dan Robinson from Georgetown University. Sir Roger Penrose, professor of mathematics at Oxford. And Susan Greenfield, the professor of pharmacology at Oxford, and also the director of the Royal Institute of Great Britain. Now we return to our questions, and there's a lady down here who's. We can when you take the mic.
Lovely. Thank you. I was interested in how the comparison.
Can you hold the mic in front of
yes.
you?
Yes. I can't talk without my hands. I'm so sorry. What occurs to me is that autism, where emotions are most confused in expressing themselves, like computers in their thinking. And the difficulty in selective consciousness amongst autistic people and to organize and express emotions, and also where there have been attempts to intervene by pharmacological means, the results have been extremely damaging, resulting in further serious neural damage. So could the panel please comment a bit further on their particular fields within that context?
Could the panel then, Susan?
Yep, okay. I had a sinking feeling that the mic was coming to me because as far as I understand it, and I'd like to stress that autism is not my area of research, the problem lies in attributing beliefs and ideas to others. It's not that you have no emotions of your own, it's just that you have problems attributing it to others, and indeed very small children can't attribute thoughts and beliefs distinct from their own to others. There's a little test that you may be familiar with where you show the child, or indeed the autistic person, Smarty box and say, what's in here? They say Smarties. You say, no, it's not, it's pencils. And they say, now if someone else comes in, what are they going to say is in here? And children over four usually will be able to put themselves in the position of the other person and say, oh, they're going to think it's Smarties. I know it's pencils. Autistic person can't do that. So I don't think the issue for autists, I don't think we should regard autistic people as people who have no emotions. Curiously enough, the model that is better for ones looking for clinical models of people with reduced emotions, and I stress reduced, are people clinically depressed. They often claim they feel numb, they feel no emotion, they feel cut off from the world, they feel grey and remote. And I find it fascinating to ponder, and I'm not going to do it now because there's not time, although I'm delighted to do so, ponder on what configurations or changes are occurring in the minds of such people. But even so, they still have some emotion. I don't think I'd say about any human being that they served as a model for someone with no emotion.
But there are clinical cases in clinical neurology of anhedonia.
Depression.
Where there is not depression, and in fact where there may be bona fide neuropathies. I'd hesitate to classify mental life as more computational when you strip it of its affective components. I shouldn't want to think of a computer as a sort of pathologically functioning human being any more than I'd want to think of a human being as a sort of autistically functioning computer. It's that slippery slope where we start combining things that really probably don't have very much in common.
I was not trying to confuse the two.
Okay, Aaron.
I'm not an expert on autism, but I dabble in many things, and autism is one of them. In fact, it has been said that many men are mildly autistic, and I'm probably one of them. You can check it out later if you like. But I think...
that's married men, by the way.
One of the aspects of autism that I've read about has to do with perceptual deficits, and I suspect that what's called emotional deficits may be linked to this. One of the kinds of deficits you get is the inability to do what we all do instantaneously when we open our eyes and look around, which is see things not just at the level of individual details in the scene, but at a high level of abstraction, like seeing it's a meeting, seeing it's a discussion, seeing that there are people who are angry with one another, or seeing that this is a supermarket, or whatever. Now, if there is an information processing deficit which stops the abstraction levels working in the normal way and keeps it at a lower level, then one of the things you might predict is that an autistic person might be much better at drawing, because drawing involves the ability to focus on the 2D detail of the visual field as opposed to the higher levels. And that's the fact that there are cases like that is what first gave me this idea. And I suspect that what we would find if we really went into it, and I'm sure there may be a mixture of pharmacological and other processes involved, is that there may be a collection of different deficits which are perhaps caused by some common genetic basis, but they manifest themselves in different ways. And one of them is the perceptual thing, another may have to do with abstract thinking, another may have to do with the way motives are generated, perhaps not in the same way as happen in normal people, and evaluations too. But I've already said too much.
I just want to say two things. The first is that the result of the psychologist, which was correctly reported by Susan Greenfield, that their result that children can't attribute false beliefs to others until they're 4 years old is simply false, and anyone who's brought up children knows that they can do it when they're two. The other thing is just that there is no conceptual connection between emotion and consciousness. There's no conceptual difficulty in the idea that a being could be conscious without having any emotions. It could be some sort of pure observer. It could still have perceptual experiences and so on.
But how about the other way around? Could they be...
No, the other way around, it's quite clear. I mean, emotion is just one kind of consciousness.
So the implication goes in one direction, but not back the other.
That's right, yes.
It depends on the sort of emotion. Have you never met the sort of person who's angry and he's totally unaware of the fact that he's angry? Or the person who's infatuated and all the friends know it, but the person concerned doesn't?
But doesn't it suggest that it's the lower functioning of the brain that's more easily emulated by a computer as they're being developed now? This is really what I'm trying to get at.
If by the lower function you mean the things the cerebellum does, which Susan was talking about, which we use when we play tennis or do all kinds of other skilled things, maybe birds do it when they fly and build their nests, those are amongst the things that are hardest to do in a computer. You try to get somebody to design an artificial squirrel that can run along the branches like a real squirrel. It's way beyond the current state of the art. Getting a computer to play chess is child's play by comparison.
Can I just add, I think it's rather perilous to talk about lower and higher functions in that way. I'd rather think of more fundamental as sort of the building blocks that then can get elaborated and refined and so on. So certainly I think emotion is a building block. I wouldn't call it a lower function. The control of respiration or the control of the heart might be regarded in that way, but I think emotion, anything that impinges on consciousness or is consciousness, is certainly not low in terms of brain function.
We also have some questions from the AV room, from the overflow room where people are watching, and specifically there's a question here on a card from somebody whose name I believe is Oliver Pretal, but I may well be wrong, I probably am wrong. In any case, the question, which I think is almost certainly aimed at Roger Penrose, is as follows. Is it really inconceivable that a computational device could not follow or indeed generate the argument of Gödel's theorem and even recognize that the improvable proposition, unprovable proposition must be true?
Well, my argument is that a purely computational device could not follow a mathematical argument. Well, the point is, I mean, you can make it chug through and say yes at the end, you see. You can even make it quite easily say, I understand that argument. The problem is, you know, does it really follow the argument? And the way you have to, you can't really address the question by talking about an individual example like this. And Gödel's theorem doesn't talk about individual examples. I mean, it talks about families of examples. I mean, how do you It talks about, if you like, well, the Turing version of it, which is really what I talk about, is it's concerned with procedures which are capable of addressing many, many different questions. So I don't know. We don't have the. I won't use the transparency machine. But
can I make a very quick comment? As Roger knows, there are human mathematicians and logicians who disagree about which other human mathematicians and logicians really understand Gödel's theorem.
Yes.
But are there computers that disagree as to which other computers?
It's a good thing there are disagreements. That means the arguments can be hashed out and talked about, and that's fine. But I think the basic Gödel argument is not disagreed. I can state it in a form which is not quite the usual way it's stated. But if you have a system of mechanical rules, let's call them, well, a system of mechanical rules, which are capable of proving certain mathematical statements. Now, if you accept that these mechanical rules only give you truths and don't give you nonsense, then, by Gödel's argument, you can see how to transcend those rules. You can produce a statement which is outside the scope of those rules, but yet you must accept as being true. If you accept the rules themselves, then you must accept this statement which is outside the scope of the rules. And I say you do that using understanding. You certainly don't use it using the rules. So, that's not what I've just said is not controversial. The controversial issues have to do with whether understanding is you know sort of approximate, or I mean whether you make mistakes, whether the rules are things which are in principle beyond our comprehension, whether they're in principle beyond our belief, and so on. There are issues which one has to address. And these are issues which I have tried to address in great detail in Shadows of the Mind. I'm not very much aware of people who have actually gone through all the arguments. I apologize, for some of the arguments are actually rather difficult, and I don't blame people for giving up halfway through. But I think if these arguments are going to be attacked seriously, then I think they have to be understood first.
I think this is primarily a question for Dan Robinson. I'm still not quite clear if you have to take a fairly broad definition of what a computer is and include artificial neural networks and sort of all possible very clever artificial neural networks, why you think computers will never be conscious. I mean, is it not just an engineering problem? I mean, all the stuff about envy and
yes.
jealousy just yes. still seems to be something which you can just say, we don't know how the brain does it, but the brain does it, and so, you know,
well,
we should
at some point in the future be able to use the machine which does it. I actually don't know that the brain does that. I don't know that. I take it as a plausible hypothesis. The most tragic figure in Homer is the hearthless, stateless, lawless man. And there is this ancient Homeric understanding that absent community and absent a civic form of life, one's humanity is not realized. So to raise a question about consciousness is to raise a question about the contents of consciousness. I don't take consciousness to be something separable from its contents. Those contents are so utterly determined by a given form of life, a life in society, the interactions that we have from the earliest moments, indeed from prenatal moments. Mozart makes you smarter, remember that. And therefore, Schubert makes you very smart indeed. But that's a separate topic. The question I have is what conscious contents could possibly be like for the hearthless, stateless, lawless entity, for the non-civic entity, for the entity in isolation. There'd be no conventional mode of thought. There'd be no way it could even begin to authorize its own thinking. I don't want to sound negative, and there's that horrible Woody Allen line where he says, I'd like to leave you with something positive. I can't. Would you take two negatives? And I... those of us on the angelic side of 60 certainly know that this debate, this session, symposium, would have been an absolute howler 20, 25, 30 years ago, when what we were all striving for was something nonsensically referred to as a purely descriptive science of behavior. When all talk about consciousness and cognition and the like, talk about Piagetian stages and little Billy knowing he has three brothers, one named Tom, but can't tell you how many brothers Tom has, this was all beside the point. It was a kind of lapsed psychology. Before you knew it, you'd be introspecting. You might even need a trained introspectionist to do it for you. And here we sit at the end of what Evelyn Waugh called your alleged 20th century. Here we sit, and we're talking about, we're not doubtful at all about mental life, cognition, concepts, and the like. We're trying to get them into computers. So I say, two cheers for all of this. But if you can't get these devices socially to facilitate the performance of each other, and in fact develop an axiology, develop a system of values that then come to determine the contents of thought, I think what you're going to end up with are really quite elaborate adding machines. They'll always wow us, you know. I'm sure Leibniz must have just gone up in a balloon when he figured out there was a way to do this. But it finally doesn't. It's not in the game is the problem. It's your sister won't marry one. It's the wrong way to go.
Sorry, is that a philosophical?
Look, we were going to speak alphabetically, and then I see they begin with Galen Strauss, and this is Rule Britannia. Britannia waves the rules. Do you say that?
Yeah. Could I?
It's a doctrinal position. It's not a philosophical one. You can think of it as coming under the same heading as the Pope's infallibility, doubted by no one except the Jesuits at Georgetown and places like it.
What I wanted to say, this might, I take it that when no one's actually defined the word consciousness yet, and I go with the Tom Nagel definition that if you're conscious, then there's something it's like to be you, and we think that there's nothing it's like to be a stone, but we know there's something it's like to be us. And there's obviously a question about where that starts on the chain of being. Maybe worms, maybe spiders, I don't know. But it does seem that we're talking a bit too much about human complexities here. If worms are conscious, or if spiders are, the whole mystery is already in place, mm-hmm. The mystery of how the physical can be conscious. So I just want to add that thought.
So you think that the mystery is actually situated on an emotional level, because worms presumably have things a lot more like emotions than they have things like thoughts.
It doesn't have to be emotion. I mean, when they perceive, they actually have certain qualitative experiences, that's already consciousness. As long as there's something it's like to be a worm, then a worm is conscious.
William James made use of this. He referred to a little bit of consciousness in simple animals and more as they get more complex. And he said it's like the downstairs parlor maid in Midshipman Easy who explains her pregnancy out of wedlock, and when she's talking to her employer, and she says, "But it was only a small baby, sir."
Can I say something about that? Because one of the issues that often comes up in these debates is whether it is all just a difference of degree, as if there's a sort of sliding scale in reality and there aren't any boundaries. People often assume you've either got that option or else there's going to be some great big divide, and on one side you've got things that are conscious and the other side you've got things that aren't. And I think both those views are mistaken. It's very important to understand that there is another possibility, which was implicit in what I said about consciousness not being an it but a them, a large collection of fragments of capabilities that we have, and we don't all have the same ones. We have different of the it combinations. And newborn babies have yet another combination, and a worm probably has some other tiny subset of that. And if it is a large collection of those kinds of things, if it's a cluster concept with no ill-defined boundaries, then what we can expect to find is not a continuum, nor a big divide, but lots of discontinuities in evolution when each new kind of capability evolved. And I think we have to understand all those many discontinuous steps in evolution. And it's a corollary of Darwinian theory that evolution is discontinuous, if you think about it for 5 minutes.
Yeah, I disagree with that. I think consciousness is certainly all or nothing. It's just like if you have a light source. If it's emitting even one photon, it's a light source. And there's a gap between none and one. And in that sense, consciousness is all or nothing.
Wait till you have Alzheimer's, my friend.
I'm allowing that there are vast differences of degree between worm consciousness and human consciousness. There's a whole range, but it's either there or it's not there, and that's all or nothing. That's discontinuous.
And it's the thing that you abolish, to disagree with Dr. Sloman, it's the thing that you abolish if you give someone anaesthetic. There might be nuances, you might have different types of consciousness, but I think that's fine-tuning and fine beer compared to a stone which doesn't have consciousness and a worm that does.
Perhaps I should just mention that in a paper that Stuart Hameroff and I, we actually addressed this very specific question about how many conscious events the worm would have and so on. I mean, it's slightly a joke, I should say. We don't. It's on the basis of the scheme we put forward.
No worms on
it. Well, it's a little. You can ask the worm, but.
It seems characteristic of the computational stance, to borrow the Dennett type of terminology, that these things have got to be visualized as capabilities. As far as I'm concerned, whatever sorts of many consciousnesses I have. And I admit with Aaron that I have different sorts. None of them, as far as I'm concerned, are capabilities. They're simply something it's like to be me, which may, in fact, issue in something you might care to call capabilities. Some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them go up blind alleys of simply feeling the way that I am. If I can just go back to one of Galen's points, the one which he started, in the attempt somehow to retain materialism to which I subscribe as well, I think you go too far in the opposite direction in the attempt to somehow disparage the sludge invoked by Colin on the one hand and Tom on the other by simply attenuating the sludge. Well, you see, I think what you say is that you can, as it were, make mockery of Colin McGinn and of Tom Nagel's view of this being sludge. It's obviously a more sophisticated form of sludge, but by merely attenuating it, I think you're doing a trick which is very similar to the one that Descartes did, by having totally attenuated sludge at the pineal end of the neural tube, imponderable enough to be compatible with thought, but ponderable enough at the muscular end to move muscles. And I think that that's simply having the best of bad jobs at both ends. Something else must be involved, and I suspect that it may, as Colin says, and Tom seems to imply, there may be a question of cognitive closure here and that we'll never get it.
Yes, well, I agree with that last remark. But I'm not denying the existence of the sludge. That's just how it looks to us. It really does look to us. And Susan tells us that she's held brains in her hands and they feel like a sludgy mass. I'm just saying that when physics looks at that thing, which really is a sludge, it sees this ethereal... No, wait. Physics, the things really are very, very small, and all we find are fields of force. I'm just saying a sludgy mass is a vast collocation of fields of force. And that should liberate us from thinking that something that's a sludgy mass can't be conscious. That's the only point of the move I make. I'm not sort of disparaging.
See, I'm saying that I don't think that in that interstice between these new ultra-refined and invisible particles is where the something it is like to be gets snuck in.
Oh, I don't think it's in the interstice. It's just somehow realized. It's realized in the network.
I'm sure it is, but I'll bet we'll never find out.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
Susan, yeah, I'm the person that held the brain. Yeah.
Yes.
But it was a dead brain that wasn't conscious. Yeah. So the mere quality of sludginess is neither here nor there. Yeah. And I think we could get horribly sidetracked on sludginess. Yeah.
You said it was a raw egg.
Well, raw egg, cooked egg.
When it's alive, it's a raw egg.
Yeah. So that's a critical issue. The point is that if you just hold it in your hands, you contemplate the fact it is no longer conscious but once was, and you question what has gone, what factor is now missing. The interstices are still there, the brain cells are still there, their connections are still there, something is now not there. What is not there, the thing is no longer in the body, you're no longer having chemicals being squirted all over the place and around. I would therefore venture that this might be important.
And it can't do the information processing it used to be able to do.
So I think it's very important that although it is sludgy and weird to look at and so on, that we don't get too transported away just by what the thing looks like. It's the process. And I think there's been a sleight of hand slightly as well between a thing, we keep talking about the thing, and thing, a process can also be a noun. So I think we ought to be very cautious.
You know, Leibniz wanted us to do this in the monadology. He says, look, just enlarge the head. Make it so large that you can walk through it. And we now can make it orders of magnitude larger than Leibniz had in mind, but get the same point that he was making in the monadology. If you make it so large that, in fact, the neural fibrils are larger than yourself, you can walk through this place. And as he said, you'll see activity like things being ground on a threshing floor, et cetera, and valves opening and closing. You won't see anything that warrants psychological predication. There isn't going to be a percept, a thought, and the like. I don't think the sludge factor is, again, I really don't think this is the way to go. You can make the sludge anything you want it to be, and it's going to be sludge, do you see?
That's absolutely right. And if you open up a computer and look in it and magnify everything, you won't see any fonts, you won't see any theorems, you won't see any conditional instructions, but they're all the same.
Sorry, Joe. I'd like to go back to Galen Strawson's opening talk and see whether I've got it right. What I think you were saying was that emotions are matter, and that just as perhaps 1,000 years ago, humanity would not have been able to understand light as wave formations and indeed as a material form, but now we do understand the structure of light. In hypothetically another 1,000 years, we will understand the structure of love or grief or jealousy, and that we will see them to be material in the way, albeit a very different way, that light is material. Is that, am I right in that analysis of what you said?
You're right in what I said, but not in the optimism which you attribute to me, because I agree with Jonathan Miller about cognitive pleasure. I don't think we will ever understand the connection between consciousness and matter as displayed to us by physics.
Why?
Well, you're asking me this because I don't think physics, all that physics really gives us is equations. It doesn't tell us. It gives us structural descriptions of how things are, but it doesn't tell us anything about the nature of the thing that has the structure.
But why should love be more complex than light? Taking us back 1,000 years, light would have been every bit as impenetrable as human emotion.
Which one did you say was more complex? Love?
Well, your Yes.
No, I don't think that I'm... I don't think that we will be able to understand. We won't be able to bring together the results of physics and the knowledge we have of matter in being conscious as we are.
But did you say that emotions are a different form of matter, or did I misunderstand that?
Yes, that's right. I don't think we understand the nature of matter. In fact, I agree with Russell. I've got a quotation I can give you here. Russell says, we know nothing about the intrinsic quality of physical events, except when these are mental events that we directly experience.
May I take issue with your comment about physics just being equations? And physics is about understanding. That's the crucial thing. You use the equations to aid your understanding in its understanding of how things link with other things and to dig deeper into our understanding of the nature of the physical world. But I think the word matter is a bit outdated in a sense, because it's not... used to be the case that you could think of, you know, particles as matter and the stuff in between is not matter, if you like. But there is no clear division now, and that electromagnetic fields are as much, I mean, they are also particles. And when one understands quantum mechanics, one realizes that there isn't, that the things which are called particles and things which are called fields, if you like, are all part of one thing. And I think, just to address an earlier issue about, well, the Leibniz point about could you make a machine big enough that you could, you know, get inside it and see all the workings. The thing is that you can't do that with quantum mechanics. I mean, if you like, it's a good argument against certain models of what the mind might be, physical structure. And I agree with it. I think the argument is a good argument.
But it's an argument against sludge arguments for metal.
It's an argument against a certain picture of what's actually going on in mentality. And I think I don't have anything against the argument. It's it was put forward a long time ago, but it's in a sense holds now. But there is something in our quantum understanding which has this, first of all, this very global character. So in the kind of point of view I'm putting forward, is that you can't break it down into individual units and see what they do. There is a global aspect to it, and one already sees this in certain types of physical system, and that's when I referred to, I'm pretty rather briefly at the end, things like superconductors and so on. You simply can't understand the behavior of a superconductor by breaking it down into the behavior of the individual electrons. There is something of a global aspect to this which is involved. And I think that that is going to be part of our understanding of what's involved in mentality.
Yeah, to follow on from that, I think part of the problem is trying to reduce it just to quantum theory. I think the way forward, and I hate this cognitive closure thing because it's so depressing. Of course you don't think there's an answer, because if you did think there's an answer, you'd have the answer. I mean, it's illogical to say it. Yeah, so, I mean, it's like saying in the 15th century, you know, we'll never fly or something. I mean, until you do it, then you have the answer.
It's
so,
a special case.
Yeah, so that's a special case, of course. Yeah. Well, you would say that, wouldn't you? Anyway. just to amplify what Roger was saying, and having looked at what he and Stuart Hameroff are doing, for me, it's very interesting to look at quantum theory in relation to more standard neuroscience, such as I dabble in, because there are ways, and I won't go into it now, by which you can look at the specific action of card-carrying ordinary or neurochemicals in the brain and see them unlock the microtubules in such a way that they could selectively enter into quantum coherence. And I think the future might lie not just being a quantum theorist or just being a neuroscientist. Part of the problem with conscious studies has been that everyone's wanted to have the terrain all to themselves. And I think if we can look at this by actually being problem-driven rather than subject-bound, then we actually could see some interesting things. And the problem is to reduce it to one technique that is doomed to failure,
I'm all in favor of it, what you're saying.
Yeah, but I think there are ways forward, and they're very exciting ones, as long as we can cross the boundaries of our disciplines.
I just want to say something depressing, then. have I got time? Yeah. Just to say that all understanding is always understanding relative to something that you take for granted. And as many people have said, not only Wittgenstein, understanding comes to an end. There comes a point where you just said, this is what happens, this is what correlates with what, and you can't claim to understand it. Understanding just can't go all the way down.
Wittgenstein didn't understand the history of science.
Hello?
Yeah.
I agree with Professor Greenfield that there ought to be that we shouldn't be defeatist about what we can understand.
Yeah, but could we have a question? We're running rather short of time.
Okay, so I'd ask in that case, Professor Penrose, why did you jump at this link between quantum mechanics and classical physics as a place where we should look for an understanding of the mind? What are the experiments which you glossed over?
Mm. Well, the reason for looking there is that it is a big gap in our present understanding. And it's a gap at the level which could be relevant to biological processes. I mean, you could say there's a gap in understanding. We don't know what the masses are, what rules the masses of fundamental particles are, and so on. There are lots of things we don't know in physics. But this is something we don't know, which is absolutely crucial to the level at which you might try to apply quantum mechanical ideas in biology. Because the way quantum mechanics is presently understood is you have a small system, which is your quantum system, and outside you have your observing apparatus or your observer and things like this. And you don't have a way of treating a system in which there is no boundary between the quantum system and the classical level. And there's something quite fundamentally missing from the way we understand physics. And it seems to me it's by far the most likely place. I'm not saying it has to be there. It's just the most likely place that something which is fundamentally absent from our physical theory is could be where consciousness comes in, because it's at the right kind of level for certain processes which go in the brain and so on. Certainly in many biological systems. The experiments have specifically to do, they're physical experiments, and they have to do with testing whether or not when you have a certain amount of it's a Schrodinger's cat, if you have a displacement of mass, in quantum mechanics you have to have these superpositions of different alternative things which might happen. And if these two alternative things involve a mass displacement, then according to me, you will actually objectively get a reduction to one or the other. So the superposition won't persist. And you can divide its experiments with tiny crystals about the size of a speck of dust. And one of the ideas is to put this out in space and send X-rays to mirrors which are an Earth diameter away and so on and so forth. I won't go into the details, but they're quite specific experiments, which there are more than one of these things, which I hope will be taken on. Probably won't be done for quite a number of years, but at least they're only testing that part of the physics. It doesn't address the issue of whether consciousness got anything to do with it. But our model, certainly the model with Stuart Hameroff, depends crucially on that. So our model is wrong if these experiments go the wrong way.
Okay. We've got time really for one last question. I had been going to ask the members of the panel to sort of sum up their views, but they seem to be getting on quite well enough without any such intervention. We're not going to waste any time with that and keep on with the sort of conversation that has been developing. Who then is going to ask the last question? I think that gentleman there. Yes, you. Oh, sorry, you've already had, sorry. No, okay, true. Okay, lady at the back then.
Is this topic for debate, is it a partial question, are brains computers? Is there an implication, are brains only computers? Because it seems to me the clever things that brains do, even at a very young age, are like recognise faces, babies recognise faces, I believe, within hours of birth. There's a question of imagination and using metaphor. And as Jonathan Miller is here, the question of what brains do when they enjoy opera or direct opera and theatre. So is there that part that we need to understand that seem to be not, in a sense, like a normal computer, which is more like a clever 16-year-old playing chess?
Okay, so the question really is there something about metaphors which computers can't do?
Look, computers aren't merely computers. If you really work with computers, you realize that it can be all kinds of things. They can be chess players, they can be word processors, they can be spelling checkers, they can be mathematical tools, they can be all kinds of things. They can control, they can fly airplanes and control factories. I think if you want to understand what consciousness is, and I think some people here maybe give me the impression that they hope we won't understand, as opposed to having any good reason for thinking we won't. If you want to understand what it is, I think, and I suspect that Roger and Susan at least will agree with me, we have to think of it as a biological phenomenon. It is something that once upon a time wasn't there, at least on Earth, although all the physics was there and all kinds of stuff was there, and then later what we understand by consciousness was there, and then all kinds of other things happened in between about which we don't have any clear ideas. So maybe we have to really look in great detail at what it is that happened in our history. What changes made it biologically useful for something to be able to do certain things? Jonathan, who seems to have gone, objected to talk about capability. Oh, he's just shy. Our notion of capability may have to be unpacked quite a bit, and to show you what capabilities are involved in experiencing a red patch would take about 3 hours at least. So I think we have to not ask, is it just this or is it just that, but what are these extra things that are biologically important? How many of them are there? What different combinations of them are possible? And I have so far absolutely no reason to believe that Roger is right in saying that it depends on some low-level physical stuff that we don't understand yet. But he might be right. It's an empirical question. We might discover one day that there's something about the way brains of and also earthworms and other things work that depends on quantum gravity effects or whatever that we don't understand. But we have to get down and do the real work. And don't assume that you know what computers are and that they're all that different. Or even that a lump of mud can't be something about what it's like to be a lump of mud.
And I think the problem with the evolutionary approach is it puts emphasis on behaviors, responses, and therefore on learning and memory skills. There's been some admirable books written by a variety of people on the differences as we get more complex, on how much more we can problem solve and how this is beneficial as we are evolving. I think that really is distorting the critical issue, which is about feelings. And the whole point is that, of course, that all that could happen, you could have those responses if you're a zombie. And the whole point is what's happening internally. And I think by looking at evolution, it might not actually be as helpful a strategy as one might think initially.
I think we have to understand why that was important for evolution. And you and I may have to talk for a few years.
Absolutely.
I think I'd like to reinstate the word merely when we talk about computers. And I mean, true, they do all sorts of wonderful things, which I certainly don't deny at all. But, okay, it doesn't mean there isn't a level above which they aren't capable of progressing to. And we know in mathematics that there is. And we know that it's a very clear thing within certain areas of mathematics, that there are things outside computation. Now, whether they actually occur in the physical world is an issue. I agree with Aaron, we have to look to see whether that's true, and you have to look at the arguments about Gödel's theorem, you have to look at physical things, you have to look all sorts of things within the brain, you have to see if there's a chance whether these quantum coherent phenomena are playing a role. But it does seem to me there is a crucial difference. So when I use the word merely for a computer, I'm talking about a certain level beyond which purely computational entities cannot proceed, and there is something outside that level. There's something which is mathematically understandable, which often mathematicians are often talking about these things. So it's not a familiar thing to people, I think, on the whole, that there is this kind of boundary of what can be achieved by computers. But I think, although they can do wonderful things, and I agree with that, I think the word merely is appropriate. But, of course, it's not. It depends what level you're talking. But, I mean, when I say it has sense to say merely, I'm just saying there is a level beyond that, and we can look back down and say, okay, those are merely computers.
Well, with apologies to Melvin Bragg, who heard this earlier today, and maybe several others of you did. You have a large audience. Maybe they all did. There was a wonderful debate. It was actually staged in print when the Birmingham Technical Institute was to become the University of Birmingham. It did so in part as a result of a substantial gift from a commercial man by the name of Josiah Mason. You may know this story very well. It was one of the terms of the gift that, quote, classics not be taught. The Founders' Day address was given by Thomas Henry Huxley, and that prince of debaters. And Huxley, in the course of his address, said that given that a person striking out on life, in which he would hope to have some effect on the world, could expose himself to two curriculums of study, one featuring a pair of dead languages, he said, perhaps of some use to a future reviewer of books, and one devoted to the laws of science. Is there any doubt in anybody's mind which would be the right curriculum of study to follow? He said anybody's mind, except perhaps for that famous Levite of culture, Matthew Arnold. Now, as you know, Huxley and Arnold were friends, and they did tweak each other from time to time. The fatal mistake Huxley made was that he mentioned Arnold by name, giving Arnold an opportunity to write one of those wonderful Arnoldian essays in which he says, my unsystematic thought is well known from one end of this country to the other, and I can't debate Huxley on science. He said, but I've been thumbing through the book of Huxley's famous friend, our greatest natural scientist, and then he takes a passage from Origin of Species, and he gives the quote, quote, our ancestor was a hairy quadruped with pointed ears and a tail, probably arboreal in his habits, close quote. Arnold says, very possibly true. And in any case, I can't debate the point. But regarding this poor chap, this hairy quadruped with pointed ears and a tail, no doubt arboreal in habit, there must have been something in him that inclined him to Greek. That's my summary statement.
Thank you. I hope you've all found the panel as wonderful as I have. Maybe marvelous. Thank you all.